This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel here of trumpet writers eager and ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
We also have Anthony Chibadeway.
Hello there.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
On today's show, we're going to give several important news items from the world of religion. In the Western world, society is becoming more and more aggressively secular. But the fact is, religion is playing an increasingly important role in world affairs, and mostly not for the better. And when you look through the lens of biblical prophecy, you really see this is a very important trend to watch. We're going to look at evidence of the assault on religion in the West. We're also going to talk about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But we'll start by looking at the unification of Protestantism with the Catholic Church. Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on Wednesday. It's the cover story of this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. This is an event specifically prophesied in the Bible, and it's something we've been looking for and expecting for several decades. And some major steps were taken this week toward its fulfillment. And to talk about this, we'll turn to the author of this week's cover story on the subject, Richard.
Yes, on Wednesday this week, the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury, they held their first public prayer session since the Church of England broke away, which was about 500 years ago. So it was a major milestone for unity. The event was the 50th anniversary of the Anglican Centre in Rome, and this is kind of an embassy for the Anglican community within Rome. And there are a whole load of events designed to foster unity between the two churches because of that anniversary. So they held a Catholic service in Canterbury Cathedral, kind of the headquarters church for the Church of England. The Archbishop of Canterbury traveled over to Rome. He met with the Pope. They prayed together. They laughed together. There was, some video footage of the Archbishop of Canterbury telling the Pope a joke. Worked on some more practical things as well as this symbolic prayer. And I should say just with those prayer, it also happened in the church from which Saint Augustine left to then go and bring the Catholic Church to England. So it was a very symbolic location there and emphasizing that designed to emphasize that the Anglican Church in England grew out of the Catholic Church, was planted in England by the Catholic Church. So it was designed to emphasize those Catholic roots. The other thing that these two churches, they commissioned 19 bishops now to work together all around the world on practical ways to have unity. So, for example, these bishops will be doing joint projects together in the communities. They will be having kind of service swaps where they'll go and give church services at each other's churches. So there was a lot done to just to really try and promote unity between these two churches and a lot of effort on bringing the Anglican Church back to Rome.
This has been going on for quite some time, for some decades. You mentioned the 50th anniversary mm-hmm. of the Anglican Center. But what's motivating this push? Why do they feel like this is such an important thing to pursue?
That's an interesting question. I think it's always controversial when you start trying to look at motives in religions. I think everyone involved would say they're motivated out of a Christian sense of duty and about all the Bible scriptures that talk about churches being one. I think what's important to recognize with the Catholic Church is that it's not just the Church of England that they're making major steps towards unity with.
Before we get into some of the other efforts that they're making, this is kind of an interesting question. I think from a Catholic perspective, it seems like that's always been their motive. They've always yes. wanted to kind of draw these churches that protested against them back to their fold. What would be, say, the motive on the Anglican side? Why would they be putting themselves in a position where they would essentially be accepting the authority of the Pope?
Yeah, it is interesting. I'm not as sure on the Anglican Church, but I know the Lutheran Church in Germany, I remember hearing comments from a bishop a couple years back where he was saying that the Protestant Reformation was kicked off when Martin Luther nailed his 95 demands on the door of the church in Germany, which was actually exactly 499 years ago. Next year will be the 500th anniversary of that. Mm-hmm. But he said they were protesting against, the Lutherans are protesting against corruption in the Catholic Church. And in this bishop's view, at least, that those corruption issues had been resolved. So he said the underlying reasons for the Protestant Reformation didn't even really exist anymore.
Yeah, that wouldn't necessarily apply with the Anglican Church, though, would it, Richard?
No, I think it was more about independence from Europe, and it is interesting that they're doing this at the same time that Britain is splitting from Europe. The Church of England was very much against Britain voting for independence, so you can see it's kind of off pursuing its own agenda now while the rest of Britain is gearing up for Brexit.
I wonder if part of the Anglican motivation could also be to present sort of a unified front against the rising tide of secularism. They see the power of the Anglican Church eroding as fewer and fewer people are interested in Christianity, and they say, hey, if we join forces with the Catholics, we can be more of a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. It could even be, I mean, you look at secularism, the rise of secularism, we'll talk about more of that in just a bit, but at the same time, you have the rising tide of Islam.
Right.
And so with the threats facing the world, well, it's interesting. But Richard, maybe you could just go on and tell us about some of the other efforts that the Catholic Church is making to bring some of the, including the Lutherans, some of these other churches back into their fold.
Right. It is very clear that they're making this an especial priority right now. You mentioned it's all they've always wanted these churches back, but they really do seem to be pursuing this exceptionally hard at the moment. So a couple of weeks ago, a theological commission made up of Catholics and Orthodox, they signed an agreement on the historical status of the Pope in the early church before the Catholics and Orthodox split. And this is very important because a big part of the split between these two revolves around exactly how important the Pope is. They all agree that he's the head of the church, but the Catholics see it more hierarchical, Orthodox see it more as first among equals. So for them to come up with a joint position on this is a major step forward. And then the Pope was in Georgia just this week, and he gave a speech there, and he told Catholics not to try and proselytize, preach, and convert to Orthodox. And this has been another practical bone of contention between Orthodox and Catholicism. Orthodox churches, they often accuse Catholicism of trying to poach their members, because Orthodox is split very much into regional. You have the Russian Orthodox Church that operates in Russia, the Greek Orthodox Church that operates in Greece, and they're very much about not conflicting in each other's regions, whereas the Catholic Church, Catholic means universal. And so they've constantly accused the Catholic Church of poaching their members. So the Pope's statements here, they may go a long way towards reconciling those groups. So those have gone a huge distance towards reconciliation. They agree basically that the Pope is in charge. They agree that each other's communions and things like that are valid. There's still a little bit to hammer out to make it so that you could just go into any church and receive any of the churches and receive communion. But they've made a lot of progress. And then the Pope is traveling right at the end of this month, October 31st, to Sweden for the opening ceremonies of the 500th anniversary year of the Reformation. And Martin Luther, I don't think he ever actually did nail his 95 theses to the door, but that was the symbolic act that started the Reformation. And so they'll be commemorating that. They've made huge steps towards unity. Andrew mentioned the corruption in the Catholic Church. The other big doctrinal disagreement was about the meaning, or one of the other big doctrinal disagreements was about the doctrine of justification. They've sorted that out as well. They've come out with a joint statement where the Catholics and Lutherans now agree. So one Lutheran bishop, they said 500 years ago, wars were fought over the very issues about which now Lutherans and Roman Catholics have achieved consensus. One Pentecostal minister, he said, Luther's protest is now over. So a lot of people, that's come a long way towards unity. And at the end of the month, with this kickoff of this 500th anniversary year, that I think is going to go a long way now to bringing that to a close. And there was even talk about achieving intercommunion at this anniversary year, which would be where a Lutheran could go and go to Catholic church services and vice versa, and that all be considered basically one church. And they're very close to achieving that. I don't know whether they'll quite get there in this 500th anniversary year. But then even all around the world, you've got efforts with Catholic Church and Presbyterian churches recognizing each other's background. The church has even reached out to Pentecostal groups. So a lot of big important bits of progress on you rebringing all these churches back into the Catholic fold.
Any longtime Trumpet reader is going to find this article or this subject of great interest, because this is something that we've been talking about for a long time based on biblical prophecy. Richard's article is called Archbishop of Canterbury Prays with the Pope for First Time in 500 Years. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com. It's also the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly. It points to the chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, called Returning to the Fold, which describes Herbert W. Armstrong's statements that this would happen based on biblical prophecy going back decades ago, where he was tracking some of these efforts that were happening even in the 60s. It's definitely worth reading this. I would urge every listener to go and look at Richard's article and even click through to that chapter in the He Was Right booklet. This is in the Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report that you can have for free in your email inbox. And we'd be happy to provide that to you at no cost. One more comment, Richard.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, this is something that Mr. Armstrong has forecast for years and years and years. But then it's also interesting to see it's happening right now when Europe really needs unity, when Europe is there's a religious element with the Islam coming into Europe. Christianity within Europe is split between these main groups, and now you see it coming together right when Europe also desperately needs some unifying force. So I think that timing now of these prophecies being fulfilled is just really fascinating, and you could easily see the unification of Europe as a 10-nation superpower and the unification of the Catholic Church, kind of both those longtime prophecies just flowing together and moving very quickly.
Thanks for that, Richard. Moving on, in America, the religious trend we're seeing more and more is an attack on religious freedom, which is guaranteed by our Bill of Rights. Developments this week in Massachusetts show one of the latest such attacks. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Right. Well, some of you may remember that last summer, actually June 1st to be specific, the Massachusetts state's legislature passed a bill banning sex-segregated bathrooms in public places, that men or women should be able to choose whichever bathroom they want to use, which caused some question at the time. Figures like, well, what about churches? I mean, surely if your religion teaches that homosexuality or transgenderism is a sin, you wouldn't force a church to let a man use the woman's bathroom. Though just this past week, it looks like that's exactly what the Massachusetts state government has in mind, in that the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, it's an administrative agency at the state level, there's released a manual describing the nitty-gritty nuances and details of that law, and explaining that it is definitely, once this law comes into effect next year, churches will be required to let anyone use whichever bathroom they choose if the service is open to the public. If it's a closed-door service for just their own members, that's one thing. But if they're holding like a spaghetti dinner or a public meeting, they have to let them use whoever walks into the church has to be able to use whichever bathroom they want. And not only that, they also have to be addressed by whatever pronoun they prefer. If it's a man who thinks he's a woman, you have to call him she. If it's a woman who thinks he's a man, you have to call him, whatever that other pronoun. Even I'm getting mixed up here now, but you can see how this would be a problem, is that it's not only the pastors of the church, but even the members. If there's any member or any pastor in that building who refuses to call a woman a man or a man a woman, they can be punished for that. The headline from the Federalist in our Trumpet Weekly talks about pastors being jailed for using the wrong pronoun, Now, I think the actual manual here from the Massachusetts Organization Against Discrimination hasn't actually said what that punishment will be. Could be jail time, could be a fine. It does look like it's not going to be tried judicially, but will be tried by the administrative agency. That's becoming more and more common in America, where Congress or a state legislature makes a law, an administrative agency in the either a state-level executive branch or a federal-level executive branch interprets that law into like 10,000 regulations, has their own SWAT teams to make arrests for those who break those regulations, and has their own courts to try those who break those regulations.
You're talking about the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination having this kind of regulatory and enforcement power.
Right. I'm not sure if that that particular organization will have enforcement powers for arrest, but it does look like they will be able to try with their own administrative courts those who break their administrative regulation.
Well, it'd be definitely interesting to see how that plays out, just what kind of power they are given to be able to enforce those things. I guess it's one thing to issue a document, but another thing to actually start seeing pastors or church members jailed because of that type of thing, or punished through fines or whatever right. other punishments they may devise.
It is definitely a trend to watch, and this isn't a one-off thing. I mean, Massachusetts is the latest state, but Iowa basically did the exact same law earlier this year, where I guess in Iowa they call it the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, where they had said that they're going to expect churches to let whoever, if the meetings are open to the public, let them use whatever bathroom they want. The members have to address the visitors by whatever pronoun they want. And I think they even went so far as saying the preacher can't even say, isn't even allowed to say anything like offensive against homosexuals or transgenders in an open service. Otherwise, he'd be subject to those same punishments, which is shocking because, like you'd mentioned in the beginning, there is a constitutional right to free speech and free religion. There's no constitutional right to not be offended.
Right.
You can, if at this point they're saying that if you say something and it offends someone else, well, we can punish you or fine you or put you in jail for offending that person for being homosexual, which you can just see how that spiral out of control. Who's to say what's going to offend someone? If offending someone becomes illegal, you pretty much need thought police.
Yeah. Richard, you had a comment.
Well, actually, I had a quick question for Andrew. I was wondering whether you say they have to use whatever pronoun they want. Does that include some of these things like Zim or Zer that we've heard from the transgender move? Do they have to use that if they...
I'm assuming so, that particular pronoun wasn't mentioned in the document. I've heard the Z so much. It was kind of funny. I know at a university level, I know a university made the same rule that you have to address them by whatever preferred pronoun, whether it's he or she or the. So one of the students with a little bit of a sarcastic streak listed down his preferred pronoun as His Majesty. So I guess now, according to the university bylaws, his professor has referred to him as His Majesty John Smith III or something like that.
Yeah, I like that. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Clamping down on religious expression takes a different form in Egypt, where the radical Muslim Brotherhood is outlawed, yet it still represents a significant portion of the Egyptian populace. This week, Egypt's government announced it had struck a blow at the Muslim Brotherhood. To talk about what the consequences might be in this volatile country, we're going to turn to Anthony Chibadewe.
There's been yet another senior Muslim Brotherhood leader who has been killed by the Egyptian government. And there's a general consensus among analysts that such targeted killings further compromise security and stability in Egypt. Now, this latest killing that we reported on in the Trumpa Weekly, what makes it worse is the manner in which it occurred. According to the government's version of events, this individual, his name is Mohammed Kamal. He was the leader of the armed wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the younger movement of the Brotherhood, which is considered more violent. the government's version of the story is that all they wanted to do was to arrest this individual. So they went to his place of residence, I suppose, and all they wanted to do was to arrest them. But then there was a gunfight and he was shot and killed. But the Muslim Brotherhood does not buy this version of the story. The Muslim Brotherhood believes that the government arrested him, took him over to a police station, and then killed him. So at this point, it doesn't really matter, I guess, who is telling the truth. What matters is, what do the people believe? And the most Egyptians voted for the Muslim Brotherhood a few years ago. And it seems like they would be more inclined to believe the Muslim Brotherhood's version of the story. The Muslim Brotherhood explained that he was just on a balcony and then he was taken out and shot and killed. And the Muslim Brotherhood made this announcement. They said, "This could lead to more irresponsible acts of violence by the young people." So they even acknowledged that people might react irrationally because of this. In a sense, that's maybe they're actually giving people permission to act irrationally. But I guess this is a point where it doesn't really matter exactly what the truth is. The fact of the matter is that people are outraged, and this is something that has happened before even in Egypt. Last year, there was something almost identical to this that happened. It followed the Egyptian government's death sentence that they passed, that they upheld against Mohamed Morsi, the former president of Egypt. After that sentence, there was a document that was spread by the Muslim Brotherhood that said that Egyptians are duty bound to strive for complete elimination of Sisi's government, and they say that Egyptians should do so by all legitimate means. Now, following that announcement, there was a senior prosecutor in Egypt that was murdered. And then the Egyptian government sought retribution for that. And they wanted to arrest, quote-unquote, arrest some terrorists. And then they ended up killing them. And again, the Muslim Brotherhood claimed that that's not what happened. These individuals were actually arrested, taken to the police station, and then they were killed. And everyone was outraged, at least people who support the Muslim Brotherhood were outraged by that. And this is just another way that Muslims in Egypt who are supportive of the Brotherhood are just going to be irritated and agitated by developments like this.
Yeah, there really is quite a lot of tension between the government of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and a significant part of the populace, which really is supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, last year the Muslim Brotherhood made this announcement. They said, come out in rebellion and in defense of your country, yourselves and your children, destroy the citadels of his oppression and tyranny and reclaim Egypt once more. So this is a problem that's growing more and more and more in Egypt, and it's something that's important to watch because the Bible does indicate that Egypt will be somewhat aligned with radical Islam led by Iran. So development like this are important to watch because they could lead to that outcome.
Oh, thanks for that, Anthony. For our next story, we're going to travel over to Asia. One of the big geopolitical trends we're following is how these nations are coming together in a single grand alliance. There's been a lot of significant conflicts and differences among them, but more and more we're seeing these pushed aside or resolved. And some evidence of this trend took place this week between two longtime rivals, Japan and Russia. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, for about seven decades now, the relationship between Moscow and Tokyo has really suffered because of a dispute over the status of an island chain off of Japan's north coast. Japan calls them the Northern Territories, and Russia, which presently controls those islands, calls them the Southern Kurils. And actually, since this dispute has remained unresolved since the end of World War II, Russia and Japan are technically still at war. This dispute has kept them from ever signing a post-war treaty. But now, Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe seem more determined than ever to finally settle this issue. And these two men are in somewhat of a unique position, I think, as compared to their predecessors, at least, to actually do it. First, there's Putin. If you think about back in the Cold War era, discussion by any Soviet leader about relinquishing territory would have been pretty much unthinkable. The USSR was all about growing larger and never really ceding an inch of land. But Putin's recent expansionist actions in Ukraine and even in Georgia, going back to 2008 there, those actions have really cemented his standing as a conqueror. It has earned him a reputation among the leadership and just the people in Russia as a man who is determined to expand Russia's power and its territory. So because of this reputation and this standing, Putin might have sort of earned himself some leeway that his predecessors would not have had, leeway to consider a small territorial concession to Japan in exchange for some very desperately needed political and economic cooperation with Tokyo. And then in Japan, with Prime Minister Abe, it's a similar situation. He has proven himself more resilient at the helm of Japan than many of his predecessors, and he's also established a reputation as a hawkish and very pro-Japanese leader. He has cemented a lot of domestic clout by taking a very hard stance toward China and North Korea, and all of this has probably earned him the trust, in a sense, to make a compromise that his predecessors wouldn't have been able to make. He could maybe agree to take back just two or three of the four disputed islands and possibly sign off on Russia keeping one or two of those, or at least some of the territory. So analysts believe that Putin and Abe are in a unique position to pull this off and that they actually could do it. But I think that what's even more important than this ability is the need, the increasing need that that both Russia and Japan have to mend ties with each other. Russia is still struggling quite a bit from the sanctions that were levied against it for its annexation of Crimea back in 2014. And then also the oil prices are in a big slump, which puts a big strain on the Russian economy. Mm-hmm. Moscow could really use some investment right now from Japan. And then Japan, for its part, is becoming more and more worried about its security dependence on America. Abe and others in the leadership there do not have very much faith in that agreement. It certainly hasn't helped that U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump has recently come out and said that we need to reconsider all of our very expensive and far-flung military agreements, including the one with Japan. So Abe and others in the Japanese leadership see that the need for Japan to kind of not put all of its faith in one nation and to consider forming partnerships with countries like Russia instead of or in addition to the one with America is growing pretty quickly.
Right. The same trend that's kind of driven some of those reconciliatory efforts between Japan and China.
That's exactly right. Yeah, these countries see that as much as they may not want to cooperate with each other, the shift happening in the Western world is forcing the East to make some compromises and reconsider some major things.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about Iran's threat to the Red Sea, a recent Nobel Peace Prize recipient, the disappearance of men from America's workforce, and some massive training drills in Russia, partially training for nuclear war. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The civil war in Yemen took a dangerous turn this week. Houthi rebels showed themselves more capable than was previously thought, which says a lot about the potential power of their backers in Iran. For this story, we're going to go back to Anthony Chibadidwe.
The Yemeni civil war has been called a humanitarian disaster by the United Nations, and what makes it worse is that it has been largely forgotten. And that's primarily because of Syria. A lot of people have been distracted by Syria, and for a good reason. But the United Nations said this, it's probably one of the biggest crises in the world, but it's like a silent crisis because it's a forgotten war. Now, just to give you a refresher about this, the Yemeni crisis began with the Yemen Arab Spring in 2011. And that followed. What followed after that was a severe political crisis between 2012 and 2014. And in September 2014, the Houthi rebels took over the capital, Sana'a. And then the civil war itself officially began in March last year. So it's been going on for about 18 months now. Up to 10,000 people have been killed. 2.4 million people have been internally displaced. 120,000 refugees. 21.2 million people, which is about 80% of the population, needs humanitarian assistance. Now, the critical fact that's often overshadowed by all these stats is this. This is essentially a war between Iranian-sponsored Houthi rebels and a coalition led by Saudi Arabia. And the ramifications of this war go well beyond Yemen and Saudi Arabia. As you mentioned, the Houthi rebels on October 1st, they attacked a United Arab Emirates-operated transport vessel using an anti-ship missile. Now, this happened at the Yemeni port of Mocha. Now, this incident shocked the whole world because it had underestimated the capabilities of the Houthis, I guess in a similar sense that people have largely ignored this war. Now, they were shocked when the Houthis demonstrated this capability. The Houthis said that they hit the vessel with a Chinese-designed C-802 anti-ship missile, which was purchased and modified by Iran. And the Houthis, they released a video about this, bragging about it. In the Trumpet Weekly, we have an article from Stratford that reported about this attack and said that, if confirmed, this indicates that the group has acquired new capabilities and raising concerns about the security and shipping in the waters off the Yemeni coast. And we know that right in that area, you have a lot of oil that's moving there, about 3.8 million barrels of oil passing through that area every day. Stratfor say that the apparent threat they pose to coalition vessels and civilian shipping in the Red Sea is clear. And that should be clear to our readers and our listeners because in April 2015, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury warned exactly about that. He wrote an article titled, Iran Gets a Stranglehold of the Middle East. And it talked about how Iran is using the Houthi rebels to get a stranglehold on these vital shipping lanes, and that could essentially strangle the whole world.
Yeah, excellent. Well, we really appreciate you bringing that to us, and it is just shocking to see the level of suffering that's going on in that country, just how much Iran is behind that, and you just wonder how is there anybody that would actually hold Iran to account for what it has contributed to that terrible conflict. Well, is the world ready for nuclear war? It looks like Russia is getting itself ready. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Starting on Tuesday and ending a little bit later tonight, Russia is carrying out nationwide training drills that involve 40 million people. And the purpose of these drills is to ensure that Russians are prepared in the event of a large-scale disaster, including a nuclear attack from the West. There was a statement posted on the website of the Ministry of the Russian Federation for Civil Defense that explained the exercises. It says, it involves all federal and regional executive authorities, local governments and organizations, more than 40 million people, 200,000 specialists, and about 50,000 units of equipment are going to be involved in the drill. The drill will rehearse radiation, chemical, and biological protection of the personnel and population during emergencies at crucial and potentially dangerous facilities. So it was a preparedness exercise that takes place on an incredibly broad scale there in the world's largest country. And I think it's also significant that this exercise began just one day after the president, Vladimir Putin, withdrew from a major nuclear security deal that the Kremlin had signed with America back in the year 2000. Basically, Putin said that America's hostile actions against Russia mean that Russia will no longer dispose of 34 metric tons of surplus plutonium intended for use in nuclear weapons. And then these exercises also happened just a week after representatives for the Russian Emergency Situations Ministry said the government is starting a project to build enough radiation-proof shelters in Moscow to protect all of Moscow's 12 million residents if there's a nuclear attack on the capital city. So it's really clear that nuclear war is on Putin's mind, and it's on the radar of the Russian leadership, and they seem to be using some fear-mongering about America to kind of get it very much on the minds of the Russian people. And all of this coincides also with news that broke on Wednesday saying that at the same time that America has been reducing its nuclear arsenals, Russia has been boosting its own by some pretty significant numbers. If you go back to the year 2011, Russia had 1,537 nuclear warheads and America had 1,800. Now, just as of Wednesday, the reports say the scales have totally tipped in Russia's favor. Russia has increased its arsenal to 1,796, and the U.S. has decreased its arsenal to 1,367. So it's quite a disparity. And we've talked on a recent episode of the Trumpet Hour just about how dangerous it is for the U.S. to downsize its arsenal to a degree that could make a first strike by Russia possibly successful. Mm-hmm. And just how American nuclear reductions could also encourage the global proliferation of weapons, because it could make nations like China think that there's a good possibility that they could catch up with the U.S.
Yeah, it is remarkable just how you're seeing this very realistic view of what's going on here. As you're hearing statements from American politicians talking about how the Cold War wants its policy back, and they're just, downsizing and pulling back from having these kinds of capabilities. But, these are the realities of today's world. Even as you have, as Russia is making these moves, you have other nations that are proliferating and trying to build nuclear arsenal. You have nuclear testing going on in North Korea. There's a reason why Russia is taking this course of action.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, as you said, it really shows the dichotomy in the thinking between the U.S. and some of these other nations. And the result is that it's all making an already uncertain and dangerous world quite a bit more dangerous.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. The Catholic Church has longstanding ties with Latin America going back centuries. And this is actually quite significant historically and prophetically, and we expect these ties to become even firmer. This week, we saw evidence of this trend thanks to the Nobel Foundation giving a peace prize to the president of Colombia. And to tell us why this is significant, we're going to go back to Richard Palmer.
This really is breaking news. Just today, we got the announcement that Juan Manuel Santos would be receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to come to a peace deal between Colombia and the rebel group FARC. They're a Marxist rebel group that have been fighting in Colombia for about 50 years. It's been a major conflict. Around a quarter of a million have been killed, 6 or 7 million displaced. And so because of this peace deal, he has been awarded the Nobel Prize. Now, it's important to note that this peace deal actually failed. They came up with a deal. It was dependent upon a referendum. Colombians voted against that last Sunday. They rejected it by a tiny, tiny margin. I think it was something like 50.4% voted to reject it, and just about 49% voted for it. So it was just rejected. But what I think is significant about this is the Catholic Church was heavily involved in this deal. We talked about this on the Trumpet Daily radio show that aired on Monday, if you'd like to know more. But essentially, the Pope spoke very strongly about it when he visited Cuba. They've been involved in this for the past 4 years. They've had an active role as a mediator and in this peace deal. And just to highlight how involved they were, or what I think symbolizes how involved they were very well, was when this deal was signed ahead of the referendum, it was signed in a Catholic church. It was signed in a city selected because it was named after a Jesuit saint. I think a Jesuit saint was buried there. Probably the top cardinal outside of the Pope, Cardinal Pietro Parolin. He is basically the Vatican Secretary of State. He was there. He gave a mass for all of the world leaders before the signing ceremony. And then it was signed in that church. So they've been really involved. And I think it's part of an interesting pattern where the Catholic Church is becoming increasingly involved now as a peacemaker. So we've seen over the last few years some very significant revelations about just how involved the Catholic Church was with America's negotiations with Cuba, the way that, for example, there was a secret visit by a cardinal to hand a personal letter to the president. The most significant negotiations there were carried out in Rome, in the Vatican, with the Catholic Church acting as a mediator with both parties. The Pope has become more involved in the Israeli peace process. So we just see this really rising stature now of the Catholic Church as your go-to group if you're wanting to come up with a peace deal.
So that really is the story here, is just how involved the Catholic Church was in what happened here. I just out of curiosity, what does it say about the Nobel Foundation that they gave this prize, 5 days after it was voted down by the Colombian people?
Yeah, I think it's probably meant I think they disagree. I think the Nobel Foundation is probably all for negotiating with terrorists, which is what FARC are. And I don't really blame the Colombian people at all for rejecting it. But I think it shows a liberal bias, and they're probably trying to rebuke the Colombian people for rejecting that.
Yeah. Well, very interesting. Thanks for that story, Richard. The official U.S. unemployment rate is 4.9%. That's half of what it was at the height of the Great Recession in 2010. But that number obscures the fact that 10 million working-age men have disappeared from the workforce. They aren't counted as unemployed because they aren't working and they're not looking for a job. To learn about the significance of this trend, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, of course, employment statistics only make sense in context of what they're actually reporting. And like you said, that 4.9% is just people who are actively, who don't have a full-time job and are actively looking for one.
Sounds pretty good.
So it is actually a really good number. Historically, it doesn't usually get much better than 5%. You usually get some structural unemployment. Now, if you look at like labor force participation rate, which is just the big number of how many adults are in the workforce, you'll see that only 2 out of every 3 men are working. But of course, labor force participation rate also counts people who are above 65 and retired. Mm. So finally this week, they finally did some crunching to try to break down of the 30% of men not working, what's the reason? And they determined that it is close to that 5% aren't working but are looking for a job. And then it's actually about full 6% who aren't working and don't want a job. And then most of the rest are those who are retired. But no, that actually, that 6% of working age men, and for working age, they define that these days from 25 to 54. Hmm. Assuming that if you're below 25, I mean, a lot of people have jobs before then, but you might be in school or something like that.
Right.
So, but from 25 to 54, they said it is a full 6%, which amounts to, like I said before, about 10 million people. Which is just on a numbers scale. They said, so if you go back to the 1940s, it is even worse than that. I'm thinking of the 1940. In 1940, that was the comparison. It was 6% weren't working, which is what, about 1 million men. Mm. Actually, today it's 14.
14 million 14,
so
men.
So double that. 14% or 10 million.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Who aren't working because they don't want to work.
What are these guys doing?
It is a good question because they've a lot of the economic analysts are saying that this is a structural change, and that it used to be men worked very manual labor, lumberjacks, minings, which with machines, we don't need as many of those jobs anymore. So it's moving more towards high tech jobs. Mm-hmm. And women have done a better job overall than men have at getting the education required to get those high tech jobs. You have more women in colleges these days. There are definitely more women college graduates. So while they weren't never big in the, there are now more women in the workforce than men, because they've got the education to do this jobs in the new economy, which is interesting because there was another report not related to the initial report of the 14% not working because they were not, because they don't want to work. But the second report says that since the Great Reception,
the Great Reception, that sounds like fun.
So fun. I need an invite. But since the Great Recession, the number of hours unemployed men playing video games has tripled. It was about 3 hours a week before 2007. Now, if you're unemployed and don't have a job and you're a working age man between that 25 and 54, you're spending about 9 hours a week playing video games. So the thought is, if you spent some of that 9 hours actually learning a skill, the fact that the economy is not based on manual labor as much as it used to be shouldn't be an excuse. Instead of playing video games, if you actually got a community college degree or something like that, you could get the skill sets to compete in this new, more technological economy.
I would imagine that even not just technology, but even a social skills-based economy, a service economy, would tend to prioritize and reward communication skills and other soft skills that a lot of times women would probably be better at than a lot of men, and it would favor that, it would favor women getting some of those jobs rather than men.
Right.
Yeah, it is a fascinating look at just how much society has changed when you see that much of a basically an exodus out of the workforce by men as women have filled those jobs. And it has huge implications for the family and for society more generally. All right. Thanks, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. We'd be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we talk about on Trumpet Hour Week in Review are in The Trumpet Weekly and a whole lot more. We try to get the best material from prophetically significant news around the world into this 12-page report, and we give it to you for free. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
One more story about the Catholic Church. Jacques Hamil, he was the priest murdered by Islamic terrorists on July 26th. He has been put on a fast track to sainthood. Usually there would be a 5-year waiting period before he could be made a saint. However, on October 2nd, the Pope said that he was going to waive that, and so now the church is launching an investigation as to whether they can make him a saint. So I think that shows an interesting move there, and shows perhaps the Catholic Church stepping up to confront radical Islam and to make Jacques Hamel into a symbol of resistance against the Islamic State.
We'll go to Andrew.
The UK pound has dropped to a 31-year low as investors fret over negotiations over Brexit. The pound sterling dropped to below $1.28 in U.S. currency this Tuesday, as British Prime Minister Theresa May clarified that she will be invoking the Lisbon Treaty before April to start the 2-year countdown to leave the European Union.
All right, we'll go now to Anthony.
What does Afghanistan have in common with Syria? Well, Europe is struggling with migrants that are flooding into Europe from Afghanistan, and they recently struck a deal with the Afghanistan government to prevent more Afghanis going to Europe, and they gave them $15.2 billion for that. So this is just an indication of how Europe is struggling with the problems in the Middle East.
Okay, back to Richard.
The European Union officially launched its Common Border and Coast Guard Agency on October 6th. Today is a milestone in the history of European border management. The EU Migration Commissioner announced, and this is going to mean that the European Border Force now has 1,500 personnel who can quickly be deployed in an emergency situation. And as we've noted before, the very unique thing about that is these soldiers can be deployed even without the permission of the European country that they are being deployed for. So it really is a milestone moment for the European Union.
We'll go now to Jeremiah.
War with Russia and China for the United States is inevitable. That's at least according to a warning issued this week by a panel of American military leaders. The comment came while they held a discussion about the future of the U.S. military, and they said from their point of view, these Asian nations are anxious for military conflict.
Okay, back to Andrew.
President Obama said on Wednesday that last year's climate change summit in Paris might have been a historical turning point for the planet. 55 nations signed an agreement to reduce carbon emissions, which the president thinks will lead to a new era of both reduced carbon emissions and increased government regulations.
And we'll go back now to Anthony.
Suspected Al-Shabaab militants killed 6 people in an attack on Thursday in northern Kenya near the border with Somalia. The Islamist group is an Al-Qaeda affiliate based in Somalia. It claimed responsibility for the attack on its radio station, and it also claimed that it had targeted Christians.
And back to Richard.
Germany and France signed an agreement on Tuesday to share an airbase and to share some military transport planes. So they're going to share an airbase in central France that keeps about 6 million six military aircraft, not 6 million. And they're going to share some transport planes. So it's a small but very practical step towards military union between Europe's now two most important militaries now that Britain is on the way out.
I appreciate the auto fact check there. And now over to Andrew.
While many generations ridicule prior generations concerned over communist ideals, many news journalists, including Thurston Powers at The Federalist, are now starting to express concern over Black Lives Matter's transformation into a Marxist organization. While the Black Lives Matter group started in 2012 as a protest against police shooting, the platform they released last August calls for collective ownership of resources, collective ownership of banks, collective ownership of businesses, a highly progressive income tax, a guaranteed minimum income, and guaranteed government jobs, the wording of which is all lifted straight from Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto.
All right, thanks for that. Gentlemen, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com, and we would be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we talk about on this program are in The Trumpet Weekly every week. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Anthony Chibadewe.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Jefferson. Democracy will cease to exist when you take away from those who are willing to work and give to those who are not. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.